single independent woman taking control of her fertility or an Indiana white trash baby mama fuck up? Smiley face. Good question, Nina had emailed back. Maybe the reason Nina wasn't offended is that she herself had wondered, still wonders, the same thing. Truly, more than she feels upset by the last few years of her life, she feels bewildered. Her mother's lung cancer diagnosis, her mother's death, which was 5 months after she was diagnosed, 4.5 months after Nina returned to Indianapolis to take care of her, and 4 months after, unrelatedly, Astrid assured her, Nina was laid off. By that point, Nina sort of did and sort of didn't know she was pregnant. Or she suspected. But how could she have attended to the situation while her mother was dying, even if, awkwardly, hideously, the dying took longer than Nina or even the hospice workers had expected? She had adored her mother. Every year on Nina's birthday, until she turned 15, Nina's mother made a mud pie out of Oreos, whipped cream, and gummy worms, and served it in a real flower pot. And then she let Nina sleep that night in her queen-sized bed. At the appointment Nina had finally made following her mother's death, when the technician estimated the pregnancy at 18 weeks, Nina had to ask herself, as, essentially, Astrid did, if she'd waited that long on purpose. She definitely hadn't been trying to get pregnant. If she had, it wouldn't have been by a 47-year-old Indianapolis lawyer she'd met at Starbucks and gone out with a total of 5 times, a not particularly good-looking man who had never been married and didn't want kids. At Starbucks, Jeff had seen her doing the Times crossword and been condescendingly impressed. Their conversation about the pregnancy seemed like it belonged in an after-school special, except that the guy was 30 years too old. Their agreement is that he is giving her $1,260 a month in child support, and that she has full custody of Zoe, though once every 3 weeks, on a Sunday, he comes over for an hour. Conveniently, it seems that none of the three of them wish for Zoe and Jeff to be alone with each other. During that phone conversation with Astrid, Nina had been holding Zoe sideways in her right arm, Zoe's head tucked into the crook of her elbow, Nina's left pinky in Zoe's mouth, and whenever Astrid spoke, Nina was frantically making funny faces at Zoe because, pinky notwithstanding, Zoe was clearly on the brink of bursting into tears. "Le bébé is great," Nina had said. "Excellent," Astrid said. "Now go to California and make me proud." Nina had planned to nurse Zoe just before leaving the hotel for the interview, after the sitter's arrival, but Zoe won't cooperate. She keeps unlatching from Nina's nipple, making eye contact with Nina, and basically smirking. "Come on, Zoe," Nina says. But Zoe continues to refuse, and Nina has to leave. Riding in the taxi to Kelsey's house, she feels the way she used to before dates. Her heart is jumpy, and she keeps checking her face in the mirror of her compact, even though she knows how she looks, which is like hell. The interview is supposed to start at 10 a.m., and the taxi driver drops her off at 9:47. After confirming the address, Nina is surprised by both the house's modesty and its accessibility. It's a bungalow with a steep staircase leading from the street up to the front porch, a sloping lawn planted with something that looks like a cross between grass and cacti, and no hedges or fence. Given that this is L.A., specifically Silver Lake, the house is no doubt worth far more than its appearance suggests. Nina then checks on her phone and finds that Sunshine Girl LLC bought the house for $920,000 in April 2012, so presumably after Kelsey had landed the role on Copacetic, but before its first season aired, when she probably could feel her impending fame, which is why the purchase isn't in her name, but before she was officially rich, which is why the house isn't bigger. The funny part is, not counting the staircase, Kelsey's house actually resembles Nina's mother's house in Indianapolis. Estimated online value, $164,000. Nina walks around the block once, then turns and walks around the block again in reverse, not passing Kelsey's house either time. All of a sudden, it's 2 minutes after 10. She hurries up the bungalow's staircase. As she waits, she notices security cameras in two corners of the porch, positioned near the ceiling and pointed toward where she stands. She hears a dog barking, a big dog from the sound of it, then the unfastening of locks on the other side of the door, and then Kelsey Adams is standing in front of her, impossibly beautiful, wearing a gardenia-scented perfume Nina can smell through the screen.
"Hi!"
Kelsey says. She hugs Nina, and Nina wishes she had access to the footage in the security cameras and could post this hug on Facebook. Not really, of course. Nina tries to look at Facebook as infrequently as possible, but it's strangely vindicating. Something Nina has for almost 3 years pretended to herself and others, which is that she and Kelsey Adams could have been friends, almost were friends, might be true. The dog, a massive white Great Pyrenees, keeps appearing on either side of Kelsey's legs, barking and sniffing, and Kelsey laughs and says, "Calm down, Chester!" To Nina, she says, "Sorry, he gets excited by visitors." "He's fine," Nina says, and steps inside as Kelsey says to Chester in a tone of sing-songy affection,
"Can you just chill out for 1 minute? Can you?"
Chester barks, and Kelsey says,
"I'll put him in the kitchen."
From the alcove inside the front door, Nina sees an impeccably decorated living room, two white couches, a glass coffee table with a vase of white tulips in its center, and beyond that, a dining room and a swinging door, through which Kelsey and Chester disappear. The house is bigger than it looks from the outside, and Nina has the sense that no one is in it besides Kelsey. No housekeeper or assistant. In Kelsey's absence, Nina ponders whether she should enter the living room and sit down, or continue standing near the front door. She opts for the latter, and when Kelsey returns, she says,
"Oh my God, come on in! Make yourself at home!"
Kelsey is holding two glasses of ice water, which she sets on the coffee table. She sits on a couch and tucks her legs sideways on the cushions. It doesn't serve a purpose to think this, but since they last saw each other, Nina suspects that she has gained the exact amount of weight that Kelsey has lost, which is 17 pounds. When Nina was pregnant, she actually gained more like 30 pounds, so she's no longer as big as she was, but she's still at the high end of her non-pregnant weight. All that stuff about how breastfeeding speeds up your metabolism is, she's pretty sure, bullshit. As for Kelsey, she's now as thin as she could be without her thinness seeming alarming. Or maybe it is alarming. Maybe in real life it's alarming, but she still looks good on screen. Her hair is white blonde, her eyes big and blue, her skin creamy. As creamy as a baby's, or so Nina might have thought before giving birth to Zoe, whose eczema often causes her to scratch her own forehead while wailing, especially at bedtime. As Nina sets her bag on the white carpet and sits on the other couch, Kelsey says,
"This is so fun, right? How have you been?"
It seems safe to assume that, just as Nina and Kelsey have gained and lost inverse amounts of weight, Nina knows the exact amount about Kelsey that Kelsey doesn't know about her, that Kelsey believes, insofar as she's given it any thought, that Nina still lives in New York and works full-time at Gloss and Glitter. This interview was arranged via approximately 40 emails among Nina, Gloss and Glitter's executive editor, Gloss and Glitter's on-staff celebrity wrangler, Kelsey's publicist, and the publicist's assistant, whom Nina imagines was also communicating with Kelsey's assistant. The outcome of all the emails was that on Thursday, October 23, 2014, for the cover story of Gloss and Glitter's February issue, Nina would interview, is interviewing, Kelsey from 10 to 11 a.m. at her home, followed by a 45-minute walk around the Silver Lake Reservoir, after which Nina and Kelsey will immediately part ways because Kelsey has an important call at noon. No fudge-making workshops for anyone this time. "Oh, please," Nina says in what she hopes is a breezy tone. "Who cares about me? Congratulations on all the amazing stuff that's happened to you." As Nina pulls her digital recorder from the blue leather satchel she hasn't used since she lived in New York and sets the recorder on the coffee table, she adds, "Your house is gorgeous."
"I'm moving next week," Kelsey says. "I'll miss this place, though."
"Where are you moving?" When their eyes meet, Nina sees Kelsey's wariness.
"Up into the hills," Kelsey says and gestures vaguely. "West."
Nina wonders if Kelsey has stalkers. "Have you been back to Michigan lately?" Nina asks.
"I went for the 4th of July, which was really nice and relaxing. But my schedule has been so insane lately that it's easier for my family to come here. My new house has a mother-in-law suite, and I've told my family they're welcome anytime. My parents are terrified of driving on the freeway, but even that, I'm like, you can Uber everywhere."
Kelsey smiles, and really, she's so outrageously pretty that it would have been a waste for her not to appear on screen. This is what Nina is thinking when, in her pocket, her phone vibrates. She's sure it's the sitter. In normal life, no one texts her anymore. And she's also sure that she shouldn't interrupt the interview just when it's starting. Besides, isn't Kelsey too famous for Nina to check her phone in front of her? Kelsey fondly adds,
"As if Bill and Barbara Adams of Traverse City, Michigan even grasp what Uber is."
Nina fake laughs, and her phone vibrates a second time. "So all the Oscar buzz has to feel good," she says, and again Kelsey's smile is guarded.
"Obviously, it's really unpredictable how things will play out," Kelsey says. "I mean, the film is still 6 weeks away from release, but it's thrilling that people are responding to it so positively. And working with Ira Barber was a dream come true. Walking onto the set every day, I had to pinch myself."
"Are there any moments from the shoot that really stand out for you?" Kelsey pauses before saying,
"I'm guessing you know Scott and I broke up recently."
What a surprise. What a tremendous relief that Kelsey has broached the topic on her own. It's actually a double surprise, because Scott is her TV co-star. He has nothing to do with the movie. Nina strives not to sound pleased as she says,
"Yeah, I did hear about that. How are you doing?"
Without warning, Kelsey bursts into tears. Her beautiful face crumples in on itself, and rivulets cascade from her blue eyes.
"Oh, no," Nina says. "Oh, I'm so sorry."
Kelsey sobs, says,
"I'm just..."
and then waves her left hand instead of speaking. She stands and walks to a shelf, where she pulls a tissue from a box between artfully arranged books. She blows her nose and, as she walks back to the couch, says, surprisingly coherently,
"I swore to myself I wouldn't cry, but when I talk to you, I feel like I'm hanging out with one of my girlfriends from high school."
"Well, being upset about a breakup is natural," Nina says. "You are human."
"I'll tell you the truth," Kelsey says. "Scott and I were secretly engaged. Also, I was pregnant."
"Oh, Astrid," Nina thinks. "You're welcome."
"It wasn't on purpose," Kelsey is saying, "but we were both really excited. And so he proposes, and Scott isn't a super emotional person, but the proposal was incredibly sweet. He said he was so happy he'd found someone else who was grounded and had good values, and he wanted us to be a team and support each other in the crazy world of L.A. 5 weeks later, I miscarried, and literally the next day, he moved out. I'm not even exaggerating."
Then those paparazzi pictures show up of him with Amanda St. Clair, and you can tell they were staged because they're totally dressed up, practically smiling at the camera while they make out, and it's like, what the hell? Fine if he didn't really want to be with me, but I have no idea why he had to rub it in my face. Kelsey makes an enormous sniffing noise. At some point, he's being such a sociopath that I really am better off without him. But when he proposed, it felt real. Kelsey has been gazing into the middle distance, but she turns her head to the left, making eye contact again with Nina, and says, "The baby was due in early March, and that's why whenever someone brings up the Oscars, all I can think about is stuff with Scott. I would have been majorly pregnant for awards season." She frowns a little before adding, "Is it weird I'm telling you all this?" That Kelsey will retroactively declare everything she just said off the record is a possibility so terrifying that Nina almost can't breathe. Not that it will be exactly, explicitly binding even if Kelsey does, but it would be kind of shitty of Nina to take advantage of Kelsey's naivete. Plus, Gloss and Glitter will want to maintain its friendly relationship with Kelsey's publicist and agent and the rest of her professional constellation. Of course, Gloss and Glitter, Astrid, also will be disgustingly thrilled to break the news of Kelsey's miscarriage, which is why Nina must proceed very, very carefully. In a light but sympathetic voice, she says, "It's not weird at all. What you went through? That sounds so hard." Kelsey says, "Not to be, like, too personal, but have you ever had a miscarriage?" Nina shakes her head. "They're brutal," Kelsey says. "I used to think of them as not such a big deal, but they're completely awful. My OB told me I could have a D&C in his office, or I could wait at home and pass the fetus naturally, and he made it sound like six of one, a half dozen of the other, but I definitely should have had the procedure." "I'm sorry," Nina says again. "I'm really sorry." "It's like going through labor. You have real contractions that are super painful, and you even have to push. But all that comes out is tons and tons of blood. And, you know, the gestational sac. My bathroom looked like a murder scene. Scott is really squeamish, and I swear that if he hadn't seen all that blood, we'd still be together." For several reasons, Nina thinks Kelsey needs to stop. For one, because the more detail she goes into, the more likely it is she'll want to retract everything. Also, the readers of Gloss and Glitter will be enthralled slash concerned to learn of Kelsey's miscarriage, but concerned slash grossed out to hear about its effluvia. And finally, listening to Kelsey is making Nina feel an urgent need to check the sitter's texts and confirm that Zoe is okay. "That does sound awful." Nina furrows her brow. Kindly, she hopes. "I can't even imagine. Are you and Scott in touch at all?" Kelsey shakes her head. "But filming for season 3 of Copacetic starts next week, right?" Kelsey shrugs.
"I know. And what can I do but cross that bridge when I come to it, right?"
"Sorry to..." Nina hesitates, then says, "Is it okay if I use your bathroom?" Kelsey's guest bathroom looks nothing like the guest bathroom in Nina's mother's house. Kelsey's is very clean, with lots of white marble surfaces. Surely, the bathroom where she bled so voluminously is nearer to her bedroom. Nina sets down the lid of the toilet, sits, and pulls her phone from her pocket. "She has been crying since you left," reads the first text, followed almost immediately by, "She will not take any food." Nina's heart, which had slowed on entering Kelsey's house, begins hammering again. She texts back, "Did you try jar of pears?" The response is instantaneous. "I have tried everything." Nina types, "Maybe go outside with her?" She likes looking at birds. The fact that so many things displease Zoe. Nina doesn't entirely fault her for it. Many things displease Nina, too, and she has far more control over her life than Zoe has over hers. "Keep me posted," Nina texts, then stands and, in case Kelsey is listening, flushes. She feels the first ache of fullness in her breasts, an ache that very possibly is psychosomatic and babysitter text-induced. She should have worn breast pads in case she starts leaking, she thinks, but she forgot to even bring any to California. Back in the living room, Kelsey smiles sheepishly and says,
"Now that I've totally derailed things, do you want to go get breakfast? Are you hungry?"
Nina hasn't eaten since the granola bars and banana almost 7 hours ago in her hotel room. She's ravenous. She says, "Breakfast sounds perfect." They go to a place that's a diner, except that their omelets are, respectively, $22 and $27. The restaurant is a couple miles from Kelsey's house, and Kelsey drove them both there in, as Nina dutifully jotted down in her notebook, a black Porsche Cayenne hybrid. As Nina also dutifully jots down, Kelsey's omelet is egg whites only, with spinach and mushrooms, and she eats a third of it and doesn't touch her toast or potatoes. Not that the world will care, but Nina's omelet is yolks in, with tomatoes, sausage, and cheese, and she eats all of it, plus the toasted potatoes. They discuss Kelsey's TV show and her movie, which was shot in Kentucky and South Africa, and another movie she's about to star in, and actors and directors Kelsey would like to work with. Even though Nina knows that after she returns to Indianapolis, Kelsey will again seem glamorous, the truth is that, as they sit inches apart, Nina agrees with her own impression from 3 years ago. Kelsey isn't particularly bright or interesting. Neither of them brings up the topic of Scott. Nina can feel some of the restaurant's staff and other patrons registering an awareness of Kelsey's presence, can feel Kelsey feeling it, and she plans to ask what this phenomenon is like. It is while Kelsey is explaining why a particular romantic comedy is her favorite movie that Nina's phone vibrates in her pocket, 3 times in a row.
"Literally, I've watched it 100 times, Kelsey says. "The part at the end where he tells her he's dreamed of her every night since they last saw each other? So swoony." "Sorry, but I need to use the restroom again."
As Nina stands, she gestures at her empty plate and Kelsey's mostly full one and, in an excessively cheerful voice that reminds her of her mother's, then makes her sad because her mother has now been dead for a year, Nina says, "Delicious!" She has not stopped crying. The first text from the babysitter reads, "I tried taking her outside. It did not work. She does not have fever, but do you think she's sick?" There is a part of Nina, say 15% of her, that thinks, "For Christ's sake, what am I paying you for?" The sitter works for an agency that charged Nina a $200 fee to join, before the $28 an hour she is paying the sitter herself. This is roughly 4 times the going rate in Indianapolis, not that Nina has ever used a sitter back home. And of course, gloss and glitter isn't covering the expense. The magazine wouldn't have regardless, but Nina didn't tell Astrid she was taking Zoe to Los Angeles. Meanwhile, the other 85% of Nina cannot bear listening to Kelsey Adams prattle as her daughter cries in the care of a seemingly incompetent stranger. It's not that she symbolically can't bear it. It's actually physical. She feels like jumping out of her skin. Plus, Nina's breasts are now so swollen that she's tempted to manually pump them, but where? And into what? On the phone's screen, Nina sees that it's 11:50, which means the interview is about to end, apparently without the walk around the reservoir. Nina considers trying to FaceTime the sitter and Zoe from the bathroom, but, like manually pumping, this idea seems like it could create more problems than it solves. Nina rejoins Kelsey at the table, but doesn't sit.
"I know you have a call at noon," she says, It's great hearing about everything you've been up to.
Kelsey looks confused.
Aren't we going for a walk?
Oh, I assumed since we had breakfast. Nina trails off, then smiles to compensate. Of course, Kelsey doesn't really have a call.
Do you have something else planned?
Kelsey still sounds confused, but also a little pointed now.
No,
Nina says and sits. Are you finished eating? I just wasn't sure if you were finished. In her pocket, her phone buzzes yet again.
I want more coffee,
Kelsey says and raises a hand in the direction of the waitress, who comes over quickly. Nina had paused her recorder before going to the bathroom. She starts it again and says,
So where do you see yourself in 5 years?
Professionally or personally? Kelsey asks.
Either, Nina says.
Both. While Kelsey is speaking, Nina pulls her phone from her pocket. It's 2014. People do this. Fuck Kelsey's fame. And the text reads, In my 22 years as a care provider, this is the most a baby has ever cried.
I know it's such a cliche, but I'd love to try directing, Kelsey is saying. One of my role models, you know what?
Nina interrupts.
I do have to go. I really apologize, but I...
She pauses, and Kelsey looks at her.
I have a baby, and I need to go nurse her.
Kelsey seems bewildered.
You have a baby?
In my hotel room, Nina says. She's 6 months old. I never got her to take a bottle. I messed up. I have no idea what I was thinking. But she won't take one, and she's really finicky about jar food, and she needs to eat now. This is when, as if to offer proof, as if proof is necessary, as if anyone would lie about such a failure, Nina's milk lets down. There's that hardening in her nipples, then the release, the liquid spilling in two warm, fast lines, immediately soaking through her bra and shirt. Kelsey looks as if she has detected a bad smell. But when Kelsey speaks, her voice is dispassionate, almost clinically curious. She says,
Why didn't you tell me before?
Nina tries to sound respectful, not defensive, when she says, You didn't ask if I'd had a baby. Because it would have been self-centered and insensitive to tell you, Nina thinks, and because I didn't realize Zoe's existence would become relevant, and because you don't care. Aloud, she says, My daughter isn't really used to people besides me. I'm sorry that I didn't plan this better, but I'll order a taxi back to my hotel.
Just Uber.
I don't have Uber on my phone.
Where are you staying?
North Hollywood.
I'll drive you, Kelsey says, if you're trying to get there as fast as possible.
Even if there isn't apparent sympathy in her tone, Kelsey is offering a favor, and Nina is not in a position to decline it. As she sets cash on the table and they walk out of the restaurant, she knows that without the check, she won't be reimbursed by Gloss and Glitter. I'm coming back to hotel now. Nina texts the babysitter from the passenger seat of Kelsey's SUV. About 15 min. Then Nina turns on her recorder and says, So your dream kiss, on screen or off, who would it be? Kelsey turns to look at her with an expression that is unmistakably appalled. Which Nina understands, but at the same time, it's Gloss and Glitter's signature question. The magazine's writers ask this of all the subjects of cover profiles, even the occasional athlete. And getting a follow-up answer from a famous subject after the interview is 100 times harder than getting it in the moment. Coldly, Kelsey says,
I'd have to think about that.
For several minutes, they listen to a pop channel on satellite radio, not speaking. Kelsey has just turned off Santa Monica Boulevard when she says,
That stuff I told you about Scott and our breakup and the miscarriage. Obviously, I didn't mean for it to be in the article.
She sounds calm and certain, not nervous.
Fuck, Nina thinks.
She says,
Oh, I promise I'll handle it in a very respectful way. After I specially requested you to write this piece, it would be a bummer to find out that I shouldn't have trusted you, Kelsey says. And there is in her tone a new steeliness, possibly a menacing quality. A bummer for you is the implication. Even so, if there were not two still widening lines of breast milk running down the front of Nina's shirt, if Kelsey were not chauffeuring her, surely she would say delicate and suasive things. At least she'd try. As it is, Nina says, I hear you. The hotel where Nina is staying has a circular driveway in front, with a fountain in the center. When Kelsey pulls into the driveway, Nina sees that the sitter and Zoe are standing outside. The sitter has Zoe propped on her right hip, and Zoe is big-cheeked and little-nosed, mostly bald, her plump arms emerging from a sleeveless pink shirt with a fish on it, her squat little legs bent in yellow pants, her feet bare. Nina is surprised that they're outside, and more surprised that Zoe is not crying. To be sure, her expression is one of annoyance, but it's also one of scrutiny and discernment. Even spending all day in a house with her, Nina is often caught off guard by the intelligence in her daughter's eyes, and as they approach the hotel, from 30 feet away, that is, before it's really possible, Nina feels that this intelligence is trained on her. While still sitting next to Kelsey in the front seat, Nina understands that she will never see Kelsey again. They aren't friends. They never were friends. They never will be. Nina will never again interview a celebrity. In fact, she will never again write for Gloss and Glitter or any other magazine. This part she doesn't know, but 6 weeks from now, which, not coincidentally, will be 10 days before her Cobra insurance expires, she will accept a grant-writing job at a nonprofit. She will enroll Zoe in daycare. Zoe will cry nonstop for the first 6 days, and then, abruptly, be fine. Kelsey will indeed be nominated for an Oscar. She won't win, but 4 months from now, at the ceremony, she will present the award for Best Documentary Feature, and people who pay attention to such things will agree that her dress, a sheer ice-blue gown by Dior Haute Couture, is one of the night's best. In the weeks prior to and following the Oscars, she will be everywhere in the media. Her wardrobe and hairstyles, her upcoming projects, her girlish Midwestern charm. And in a taped interview that airs just before the Oscars and is conducted by a legendary octogenarian television personality, an interview Nina will watch lying in bed while Zoe sits next to her eating oyster crackers from a purple plastic cup, Kelsey will tearfully describe the miscarriage she suffered in September 2014. I hadn't gotten pregnant on purpose, but we were both really excited, Kelsey will say. And Scott isn't a super emotional person, but his proposal was incredibly sweet. He said how he was so happy he'd found someone else who was grounded and had good values, and he wanted us to be a team and support each other in the crazy world of L.A. Then 5 weeks later, I miscarried, and literally the next day he moved out. And then those paparazzi pictures show up of him with... This time, Kelsey will roll her eyes but not say Amanda St. Clair's name. Also, she won't describe all the blood, and Nina will wonder if one of her handlers advised against it, or if these are edits Kelsey made on her own. For the part when Kelsey said to Nina that she swore she wouldn't cry but she felt like she was hanging out with one of her girlfriends from high school, Kelsey will amend it to, "But I feel like I'm hanging out with my favorite auntie in Michigan." Which is tactful, given that the interviewer is probably the age of Kelsey's grandmother.
How astonished Nina will be to realize not only that Kelsey has fucked her over, but that in complying with Kelsey's request, Nina herself was showing stupidity rather than compassion. How astonishing Kelsey's shrewdness will be. It will elicit from Nina genuine respect, along with a predictable antipathy. Given that Nina's career as a journalist is finished, however, does it really make a difference? Defying Kelsey could have prolonged Nina's career, but probably not by much. As Kelsey turns her SUV into the hotel driveway, she says, still coldly,
"Did you think I'd be jealous?"
Nina is about to say no, which is the truth, when Kelsey adds,
"Of you."
But cranky, suspicious, eczema-ridden Zoe? Nina loves her so much. She's so happy to see her. Outside the hotel, perched on the sitter's hip, wearing her undignified clothes, Zoe is very familiar and dear. And it occurs to Nina that today is the first time she's ever had the chance to miss her daughter. The Prairie Wife. The understanding is that after Casey's iPhone alarm goes off at 6:15 a.m., Kirsten wakes the boys, nudges them to get dressed, and herds them downstairs, all while Casey is showering. The four of them eat breakfast as a family, deal with teeth brushing and backpacks, and Casey, who is the principal of the middle school in the same district as the elementary school Jack and Ian attend, drives the boys to drop off. Kirsten then takes her shower in the newly quiet house before leaving for work. The reality is that at 6:17, as soon as Casey shuts the bathroom door, Kirsten grabs her own iPhone from her nightstand and looks at Lucy Hedrick's Twitter feed. Clearly, Kirsten is not alone. Lucy has 3.1 million followers. She follows a mere 533 accounts, many of which belong to fellow celebrities. Almost all of Lucy's vast social media empire, which, of course, is an extension of her lifestyle brand empire, whatever the fuck a lifestyle brand is, drives Kirsten crazy. Its content is fake and pandering and boring and repetitive. How many times will Lucy post variations on the same recipe for buttermilk biscuits? And Kirsten devours all of it. Every day. Facebook and Instagram, Tumblr and Pinterest, the blog, the vlog, the TV show. Every night, Kirsten swears that she won't devote another minute to Lucy. And every day, she squanders hours. The reason things go wrong so early in the morning, she has realized, is this. She's pretty sure Twitter is the only place where real, actual Lucy is posting. Lucy, whom Kirsten once knew. Lucy has insomnia, and while all the other posts on all the other sites might be written by Lucy's minions, Kirsten is certain that it was Lucy herself who, at 1:22 a.m., wrote, "Watching Splash on cable, oops, I forgot to name one of my daughters Madison." Or, at 3:14 a.m., accompanied by a photo of an organic candy bar, "Could habit of eating chocolate in middle of night be part of reason I can't sleep, LOL." Morning, therefore, is when there's new, genuine Lucy sustenance. So how can Kirsten resist? And then the day is Lucy contaminated already, and there's little incentive for Kirsten not to keep polluting it for the 16 hours until she goes to bed with the bullshitty folksiness in Lucy's life. The acquisition of an alpine goat, the canning of green beans, the baby shower that Lucy is planning for her young friend Jocelyn, who lives on a neighboring farm. As it happens, Lucy has written, or written, right? There's no way. A memoir with recipes, Dishin' with the Prairie Wife, that is being published today, so Kirsten's latest vow is that she'll buy the book. She tried to reserve it from the library and learned that she was 305th in line. Read it, and then be done with Lucy. Completely. Forever. The memoir has been embargoed, as if Lucy is like Henry Kissinger. And to promote it, Lucy traveled yesterday from her farm in Missouri to Los Angeles. As she told Twitter, "Bumpy flying over the mountains." Today, she will appear on a hugely popular TV talk show on which she has been a guest more than once. Among last night's tweets, posted while Kirsten was sleeping, was the following. "Oh my gosh, you guys, I'm so nervous plus excited for Mariana. Wonder what she will ask." The pseudo-nervousness, along with the "oh my gosh," never "oh my god," or even "OMG," galls Kirsten. 20 years ago, Lucy swore like a normal person. But the Lucy of now, Kirsten thinks, resembles Casey, who, when their sons were younger, respectfully asked Kirsten to stop cursing in front of them. Indeed, the Lucy of now, beloved by evangelicals, homeschooler of her three daughters, wife of a man she refers to as the stud in overalls, who is a deacon in their church, uses such substitutes as "Jiminy Crickets" and "Fudge Nuggets." Once, while making a custard on the air, Lucy dropped a bit of eggshell into the mix and exclaimed, "Schnookerdookies!" Kirsten assumed that it was staged, or maybe not originally staged, but definitely not edited out when it could have been. This made Kirsten feel such rage at Lucy that it was almost like lust. Kirsten sees that last night, Lucy, as she usually does, replied to a few dozen tweets sent to her by nobodies, including Nicole in Seattle, who has 31 followers, and Tara in Jacksonville, who's the mom of two awesome boys. "Aren't we all?" Kirsten thinks. Most of the fans' tweets say some variation of, "You're so great," or, "It's my birthday, pretty please wish me a happy birthday." Most of Lucy's responses say some variation of, "Thank you for the kind words," or, "Happy birthday." Kirsten has never tweeted at Lucy. In fact, Kirsten has never tweeted. Her Twitter handle is not her name, but Miniap, plus the last three digits of her zip code. And instead of uploading a photo of herself, she's kept the generic egg avatar. She has three followers, all of whom appear to be bots. Through the bathroom door, Kirsten can hear the shower running, and the minute Casey turns it off, by this point Kirsten is, as she also does daily, reading an article about how smartphones are destroying people's ability to concentrate, she springs from bed, flicking on light switches in the master bedroom, the hall, and the boys' rooms. When Casey appears, wet hair combed, completely dressed, and finds Ian still under the covers and Kirsten standing by his bureau, Kirsten frowns and says that both boys seem really tired this morning. Casey nods somberly, even though it's what Kirsten says every morning. Is Casey clueless, inordinately patient, or both? At breakfast, Jack, who is 6, says,
"Do doctors ever get sick?"
"Of course," Casey says. "Everyone gets sick." While packing the boys' lunches, Kirsten says to Ian, who is 9, "I'm giving you Oreos again today, but you need to eat your cucumber slices, and if they're still in your lunchbox when you come home, you don't get Oreos tomorrow." She kisses the three of them goodbye, and as soon as the door closes, even before she climbs the stairs, Kirsten knows that she's going to get herself off using the handheld showerhead. She doesn't consider getting herself off using the handheld showerhead morally problematic, but it presents two logistical complications, the first of which is that the more often she does it, the more difficult it is for Casey to bring her to orgasm on the occasions when they're feeling ambitious enough to have sex. The second complication is that it makes her late for work. If Kirsten leaves the house at 7:45, she has a 15-minute drive. If she leaves at or after 7:55, the drive is twice as long. But seriously, what else is she supposed to do with her Lucy rage? Kirsten's commute is when she really focuses on whether she has the power to destroy Lucy Hedrick's life. Yes, the question hums in the background at other moments, like when Kirsten is at the grocery store and sees a cooking magazine with Lucy on the cover. It's just so fucking weird how famous Lucy is. But it's in the car that Kirsten thinks through, in a realistic way, which steps she'd take. She's figured out where she could leak the news and has narrowed it down to two gossip websites, both based in Manhattan. She's even found the Got Tips link on one. If she met somebody who worked for such a site, and if the person promised she could remain anonymous, it would be tempting. But living in Minneapolis, Kirsten will never meet anyone who works for a Manhattan gossip website. Kirsten's co-worker Frank has volunteered to leak the news for her. Indeed, he's so eager that she fears he might do it without her blessing, except that he knows she knows he pads his expense reports when he travels. And it's Frank's joyous loathing of Lucy that reins in Kirsten's own antipathy. Frank has never met the woman, so what reason does he have to hate her? Because she's successful? This, in Kirsten's opinion, isn't sufficient. Kirsten hates Lucy Hedrick because she's a hypocrite. In 1994, the summer after their freshman year in college, Kirsten and Lucy were counselors at a camp in northern Minnesota. It was co-ed, and Kirsten was assigned to the Redbirds cabin, girls age 9, while Lucy was with the Blue Jays, age 11. Back then, Lucy weighed probably 25 pounds more than she does now, had very short, light brown hair, and had affixed a triangle-shaped rainbow pin to her backpack. The first night, at the counselor's orientation before the campers arrived, she said, "As a lesbian, one of my goals this summer is to make sure all the kids feel comfortable being who they are." Kirsten knew a few gay students at her Jesuit college, but not well. And Lucy was the first peer she'd heard use the word lesbian other than as a slur. Although Kirsten took a mild, prurient interest in Lucy's disclosure, she was mostly preoccupied with the hotness of a counselor named Sean, who was very tall and could play Welcome to the Jungle on the guitar. Sean never reciprocated Kirsten's interest. Instead, and this felt extra insulting, he soon took up with the other counselor in the Redbird's cabin. Kirsten became conscious of Lucy's crush on her without paying much attention to it. Having given the subject a great deal of thought since, Kirsten now believes that she was inattentive partly because of her vague discomfort, and partly because she was busy wondering if Sean and Renee would break up, and if they did, how she, Kirsten, would make her move. Lucy often approached Kirsten, chattily, at all camp events or when the counselors drank and played cards at night in the mess hall, and more than once, she tried to initiate deep conversations Kirsten had no interest in. "Do you believe in soulmates?" Or, "Do you usually have more regrets about things you've done or things you haven't done?" When Kirsten and Lucy ran into each other on the fourth-to-last night of camp, on the path behind the arts and crafts shed, when they were both drunk, it was maybe not as random or spontaneous as it seemed, at least on Lucy's part. Kirsten had never kissed a girl, though she'd had sex with one boy in high school and another in college, and she's wondered if she'd have kissed just about anyone she ran into behind the shed. She was 19. It was August. She was drunk. And she felt like taking off her clothes. That it all seemed especially hot with Lucy didn't strike her then as that meaningful. They hooked up in the dark, on a ratty red couch, in a room that smelled like the kiln and tempera paint. Kirsten was definitely aware of the variables of there being more than one set of boobs smashed together, and the peculiarly untroubling absence of an erection. But there were things she heard later about two girls, about how soft the female body was and how good another girl smelled, that seemed to her like nonsense. She and Lucy rolled around a lot and jammed their fingers up inside each other, and though both of them had probably swum in the lake that day, neither was freshly showered. There really wasn't much in the way of softness or fragrant scents about the encounter. What she liked was how close they could be, almost fused, with nothing between them. The next morning, while Kirsten was standing by the orange juice dispenser in the mess hall, Lucy approached her, set a hand on her forearm, and said softly, "Hey." Kirsten, who was intensely hungover and sleep-deprived, recoiled, and she saw Lucy see her recoil.
"I'm not gay," Kirsten muttered.
If Lucy had done anything other than laugh lightheartedly, that might have halted things. But Lucy's willingness to act as if neither their hookup nor Kirsten's homophobia were a big deal, it made it seem okay to keep going. The whole whatever it was so clearly short-lived, so arbitrary. During the next 5 nights, the counselors stayed an extra 48 hours to clean the grounds after the kids went home, Kirsten and Lucy were naked together a lot. The second night was both the first time someone went down on Kirsten and the first time she had an orgasm. The orgasm part happened more than once. She was less drunk than the night before, and at one point, while Lucy was lapping away at her, she thought that, all things considered, it was good that it was happening with a girl first, because then when a guy went down on her, when it mattered, Kirsten would know what she was doing. After Kirsten had basically spasmed in ecstasy into Lucy's face, she said, "Could you tell I'd never done that?" It was less that Kirsten was confiding than that, with Lucy, she didn't feel the need to feign competence. Lucy was lying on top of her, propped up on her elbows, and she seemed amused, flirtatious amused, not mean amused, as she said, "Seriously? Never?" Kirsten said, "Well, I've given blowjobs." "Then that really doesn't seem fair." The sureness of Lucy's hooking-up personality, the way it might even have been more confident than her regular personality, impressed Kirsten. The nearest Kirsten got to such confidence was when things felt so good that she forgot herself. Lucy added, "Just in case none of the recipients of your blowjobs ever mentioned it, you're very, very fun to have sex with." And Kirsten said, "This isn't sex." As she had by the juice dispenser, Lucy laughed. "I mean, it's fooling around," Kirsten said. "I'm not denying that." "You think if there's no penis, it doesn't count?" Lucy's apparent lack of anger surprises Kirsten more in retrospect than it did at the time. Lucy explained that she was a gold star lesbian, which meant one who'd never had sex with a guy. In fact, Lucy added proudly, she'd never even kissed a guy. Kirsten asked how she'd known she was gay, and Lucy said, "Because, even when I was in grade school, the people I always thought about before I fell asleep at night were girls." That what was transpiring between them would be kept secret was both understood and probably not very realistic. Before they lay down on the red couch, Kirsten would block the door with a chair, but sometimes dim figures, other couples in search of privacy, opened the door part way. When this happened, Kirsten would freeze, and Lucy would call out sharply, "There are people in here!" And a retreat would occur. Once, someone very tall opened the door all the way and just stood there, not moving, someone else behind him, and Kirsten realized, with one of her nipples in Lucy's mouth, that the person in front was Sean, and Kirsten's fixation with him, a fixation that had lasted until just a few days before, seemed distant. Lucy lifted her head and said, in a firm voice, "Can you please leave?" Sean and Renee did go away, but the next morning Renee asked, with what seemed more like curiosity than disapproval, "Was that you with Lucy?" All these years later, while driving to work and considering ruining Lucy's life, Kirsten thinks that Renee would be her corroboration, and maybe Sean, too. Conveniently, Kirsten is Facebook friends with both of them, privy to the extremely tedious details of their separate suburban lives. At the time, fake casually, fake confusedly, Kirsten said, "With who?" That fall, back at school, Kirsten opened her mailbox in the student union one day to find a small padded envelope, the return address Lucy's, the contents a brief, unremarkable note, "Hope you're having a good semester," and a mixtape. Kirsten was surprised and very happy, which made her inability to listen to the mixtape perplexing. The first song was "I Melt With You," and the second line of the song was "Making love to you was never second best." And though she tried several times not to, Kirsten always had to turn off her cassette player after that line. She never acknowledged Lucy's gift. The next summer, Kirsten returned to the camp, and Lucy didn't. Someone said that she was volunteering at a health clinic in Haiti. Kirsten had a boyfriend then, a guy named Ryan, who was working in the admissions office of their college, and to whom she hadn't mentioned Lucy. After that summer, Kirsten's only source of camp updates was a winter newsletter, which she read less and less thoroughly as the years passed. She became aware of the prairie wife, in the amorphous way one becomes aware of celebrities, without having any idea that Lucy Hedrick was Lucy from camp, whose surname had been Nilsson. She even saw pictures of Lucy online and in magazines and didn't recognize her. But last December, Kirsten read the camp newsletter in its entirety. It was the day after Christmas, and she was trying to get Jack to take a nap, which he didn't do much anymore, but he'd been cranky, and they were due at a potluck in the evening. She was sitting halfway up the steps of their house so as to intercept Jack whenever he tried to escape from his room. She'd pulled the newsletter from a stack of mail by the front door to occupy herself between interceptions. The camp had been owned by the same family for several generations, and an eccentric great-uncle who taught archery wrote the newsletter. The item about Lucy was just a paragraph and not particularly fawning. "It's always fun to see what former camper and counselor Lucy the Prairie Wife Hedrick, nay Lucy Nilsson, is up to." But Kirsten couldn't believe it. Though she didn't own any of Lucy Hedrick's cookbooks and had never seen her television show, she knew enough about her to find it hilarious. She knew that Lucy Hedrick was gorgeous. She had long blonde hair and magnificent cheekbones, was married to a man, and was, in some conservative-flavored way, religious. Kirsten was so excited to tell Casey that she let Jack get out of bed. They went into the den, where Casey and Ian were watching football, Kirsten carrying the camp newsletter. But it turned out that although Kirsten had mentioned Lucy to Casey, Casey had never heard of the Prairie Wife, so Kirsten's ostensible bombshell was less satisfying to drop than she'd anticipated. That might have been that, a funny coincidence, except that a week later, at the digital map data company where she works, Kirsten passed Frank's office while he was watching Lucy Hedrick make chicken and dumpling soup online. "I'm decompressing," Frank said. "I just turned in a test tally." Kirsten held up her palms and said, "Hey, no judgment." She almost didn't say it, but then, pointing at the computer screen, she did. "I kind of know her." Frank raised one eyebrow, which was a gesture Kirsten suspected he had, in his adolescence, practiced at great length. Frank was her age, the son of Thai immigrants, and he was married to a white guy who was a dermatologist. Kirsten liked Frank okay. She respected his attention to detail, but she didn't really trust him. Frank said, "Do go on." She tried to think of reasons that not trusting Frank mattered, and couldn't come up with any. Once, she had considered her hookups with Lucy to be her most damning secret, but now, ironically, They were probably the most interesting thing about her, even if Casey had been underwhelmed. I haven't seen her since the mid-90s, but we worked at a camp a few hours north of here, Kirsten said, then added,